From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made under ultraviolet fluorescent light. Students at RIT made international news for a discovery they made related to medieval manuscripts. They developed a system that uses ultraviolet fluorescent imaging to read text that's invisible to the naked eye. This is one of those stories that is just cool to begin with, but it actually has a lot of application. In their process, they discovered lost text on a 15th century manuscript in RIT's collection. That manuscript, they learned, was actually a palimpsest. That's parchment with multiple layers of writing. The discovery and the system that the students created will help libraries around the world learn more about medieval texts and collections, maybe even recover some lost writing. The RIT project became a collaboration with the University of Rochester, where faculty and students are also making advancements in textual science. It is remarkable work that is helping reveal some mysteries of the past, and Rochester's sort of become a hub for this kind of science. So this hour, our guests discussed the recent project, its impact, what's next in their field here and around the world. And in some ways, with so much focus on COVID and politics, this is the distraction we need. So Roger Easton, who is a professor at RIT's Chester F. Carlson Center for Imaging Science, thank you for this lovely distraction and this remarkable work. Welcome.
Oh, Evan, you're very welcome. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you as well. Gregory Hayworth is an associate professor of English and textual science at the University of Rochester. Gregory, welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Also with us is Zoe Lalina, who is a second-year imaging science student. Zoe, welcome.
Yes, thank you. It's great to be here.
And Lisa Enox is a second-year student, double majoring in motion picture science and imaging science. Lisa, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let me just sort of try to set the stage for what this all how this all kind of came to be. And I'm going to start with Roger. Can you kind of give us a little bit of background about how the students came to this project and what they were learning?
Well, I guess I would say this is an outgrowth of work that we've been doing since probably the mid-90s, but the students have this knack of taking it an extra step. And that's been my experience in a number of cases and work I've done over the last 15 to 20 years. And so what they did was they took a system of their own design, and they just went around and looked at manuscripts that were available to them in the RIT collection, and lo and behold, they did something that Gregory Hayworth and I have said was going to happen. They found something that the library didn't even know they had.
Tell me a little bit more about that prediction you made, Roger. I mean, it's like we have all of these fascinating older documents, but somewhere somebody is going to discover some lost text or hidden ink because of the way these documents were sort of created, right?
Yeah, exactly. My experience with this goes back to the late 90s when a colleague of all of ours, Keith Knox, who's now out in Hawaii, he led us to the work on this Archimedes palimpsest, which is a 10th century manuscript, the oldest known writings, copies of writings by Archimedes that was erased and overwritten in 1229. And Keith and I were on the team that imaged that to try to recover the writings from that. And that was another example where an RIT undergrad student, actually a couple of them, made significant discoveries without any prompting from me. So the students, once you give them a little bit of background, they have the capability to take this to the next step.
Well, let me turn to Gregory Hayworth because, Professor, we have talked about sort of my geeky fascination with the Herculaneum papyri, the scrolls that were buried when Vesuvius erupted, and the discovery of those scrolls, the fact that we have this fascination with some of the texts and documents of the past. Some of it, I think, is just curiosity. I mean, I was reading an article recently about the somewhat recent discovery of fast food eateries at Pompeii, finding menus of what they were eating for fast food. What were they eating and drinking? Finding old wine bottles there and literally seeing what a cafe looked like 2,000 years ago when the commoners decided they wanted to go have lunch near the town square, and how cool it was to see what the menus sort of looked like and to get a look at what they were eating on a regular basis for lunch and things like that. That's sort of fascinating. But then there is the question of actual historic documents and why it matters. I mean, finding lost texts from authors that we know exist somewhere, that they are out there somewhere. And with our technology, eventually, we may be able to determine what we're looking at here. How significant is it to develop these technologies and these processes that give us a chance to sort of get back in touch with the past?
The technologies themselves aren't entirely new. I mean, you've been using things like multispectral imaging since, for at least 100 years. What's new is the digital ability to use these technologies and have non-specialists, students or researchers without a lot of technical background, use them as tools to do work on their own. And there is so much to discover that one of Roger's and my great goals has been to try to introduce these technologies and teach them in a curriculum at both RIT and U of R, to try to help students, as they have just done at RIT, to make these discoveries. And we hope that that will be duplicated elsewhere.
Well, we're going to talk to the students in just a moment, but Professor Easton, just kind of give us a little bit more about what they were actually working on, what the document in this case was, and you know, sort of what they end up discovering on it.
One of the manuscripts from a collection there was this scholar in the 1950s, I believe. His name was Otto Egge, E-G-E, who took a bunch of manuscripts and sort of cut them up to make collections of different types of manuscript, and then he sold them, or his wife sold them, and around to different places, different academic institutions primarily, and these were to be used as teaching tools to sort of to demonstrate to the students what the types of manuscripts were. And the students, there is one of these sets of collection at RIT. And the students went and looked at those, and lo and behold, they discovered a palimpsest, which had not been anticipated, had not been seen before. And one of the great things about this is these collections exist at other places, and I know the students have already contacted several other places that have leaves from the same manuscript with the hope that they, once the opportunity arises, once the COVID situation improves, the students can go and image those leaves to see if those leaves are also palimpsest.
Yeah, in other words, if you found one here, you might as well check the whole collection, it seems, Roger.
Exactly right.
Yeah, wow. Well, let me ask Zoe and Lisa about this discovery. And Zoe, I'll start with you. You're a second-year imaging science student. What did you think going into this project, and when was roughly the moment where you realized what you had kind of stumbled across?
Yeah, going into this project, both Lisa and I started this project like the first day of our freshman year. So it's very overwhelming to be given an entire imaging system to build. But we've had the opportunity to work on this project for almost 2 years now. And last year, when we were just finding test subjects to prove to ourselves that our system could just do the bare minimum, we managed to find, I think, 3 palimpsests in RIT's own Carey collection. And it was just really amazing that this thing that we had been working on for so long was able to get the results that we wanted and actually make discoveries here at RIT.
Who was the were you with a team when you first sort of saw this? Was it one of you? I mean, what was the moment like?
I was alone in the lab. I got very excited, and I ran down to my boss's office because I was like, everyone has to see this. Anyone that's in this building has to come see this beautiful palimpsest.
What a moment. What an incredible moment. And Lisa, let me bring in Lisa Enex, who is a second-year student double majoring in motion picture science and imaging science. So the first thing I think that was seen was a layer of dark French cursive. Do you speak French, Lisa?
That's actually a funny question, because we've actually discovered that me, Zoe, and another student have all taken French. However, we are not able to speak it fluently. So we've been talking to a bunch of other people who are actually, you know, specialized in this to try and see if we can decipher at least some of the text in it.
Yeah. So, I mean, in that moment, I imagine, Lisa, the first thing is just a recognition that there is something there. But how quickly did you know that it was, for example, for what language it was?
I think we were kind of looking at it. At first, we thought it might be Latin or something else, because they usually wrote in those types of languages. But after a while, we soon figured out, oh, it's French, by talking to some people who were able to decipher it. And then by then, we were able to look at it more and discover more about what it was actually saying.
What a cool thing. And, you know, Zoe, I was going to ask you if you regret falling asleep in French class when you were younger. But, even if your French was on point here, we're talking centuries old French. And there's a lot of work that probably has to be done to understand exactly what you're looking at, even if you know the language. Is that right?
Yeah. But for Lisa and I, that's not the area we usually work in. We're mostly imaging, and then we'll pass it off to people who can read centuries-old text.
Is there anything in you, Zoe, in that kind of moment as the hours are unfolding and you realize you've got a palimpsest? And are you hoping that the document is one thing or another? I mean, in other words, it could have been roughly anything, and at Herculaneum, they're hoping that what they find are lost philosophical writings from some of the really sort of massively important writers of the time whose works are incomplete. So, you know, if the workers at Herculaneum can, if the teams can slowly unscroll and decipher what they're looking at, they're sort of crossing their fingers on what they're looking at. They're hoping it's not menus from the local eatery, which is still fine, but, you know, they're hoping these are lost books. Is there anything in you that was hoping that it was something more special, or were you maybe not as focused on that?
I think even if the writing, the French cursive, is of some historical importance, just the fact that so many libraries and schools have the potential to have a palimpsest in their collection that they can use for learning and demonstration purposes is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask the professors here, and Gregory, I'll start with you. Professor Hayworth, is there a rooting interest that these kinds of discoveries are one kind of document over another?
The fact that this document actually is a palimpsest in a book of hours is what's really, really interesting.
Can you explain a book of hours for the listeners?
A book of hours was a very popular kind of a medieval book of prayers and psalms, usually in Latin. Which were, these prayers and psalms were pronounced throughout the day, but they were made for lay people. And increasingly, in the late Middle Ages, from about maybe the early 14th century on, or late 13th, early 14th centuries on, they were made in, not in monasteries, but in for-profit scriptoria in major centers. And this is what we have here. It's a book of hours, made in probably northeastern France, so not Paris, and it's made for profit. And what's really unusual is that never before have we seen a book of hours which uses reused parchment. So in other words, it's recycling parchment. Usually, because they're for profit, they're made with, you know, fresh parchment. They look really, really pretty. And this was a complete surprise. The fact that no one had seen, noticed the palimpsest is also really astounding. It seems to suggest that at the very least, they're using perhaps a new kind of process for erasing the original text and preparing the parchment to be rewritten, something that we don't know enough about. That's just one of the many questions it raises.
Yeah, and Professor Hayworth, I mean, you and your colleagues around the world have spent a long time trying to deal with the fact that the Archimedes of the world had some of their original writings erased hundreds of years later by some knucklehead who knows what they were writing. I guess they had to do that because of the relative scarcity of these kinds of writing materials or their cost.
Well, yes. I mean, they're, in this case, they're trying to make a profit. And obviously, if you can recycle, it's a lot cheaper. The fact that they did so well is what's surprising. But also that the object itself, what's really unusual about what the students found is that the undertext, which I looked at, and it's a Middle French from about 1440, somewhere between 1410 and 1440. What's really unusual about it is that the undertext was written no more than about 10 or 15 years before the overtext. So there was a really quick turnaround. So there, it seems as though there was a real, you know, kind of circle of trade going around books, in which there's this recycling of material. It hands over to a scriptorium. They rewrite it. So it's all the more important to try to find the rest of the palimpsest and recreate that undertext, some of which I've already read.
How do you know? Are you the one who knows, Professor Hayworth, that we're looking at French from the 1440s?
Yes.
That's part of your specialty. That is remarkable. How clean is the writing? I mean, how decipherable is it?
Well, it's if you've seen the pictures of what the students did, it's pretty remarkable. They take a regular piece of manuscript, which has the overwriting, which is very, very clear, and what looks like a kind of creamy beige parchment all around it, which seems to have no marks on it. And then you image it multispectrally, and suddenly lines of writing appear underneath that that original writing. Now, the original document on which it was written was much larger than the Book of Hours. So what we have are parts of sentences, and the really legible parts of the sentences are the ones that are in the margins. They don't have writing over it. And one of the things that Roger especially specializes in and has taught a bunch of us to do is to use multispectral image processing to try to reduce the overtext and enhance the undertext to make the part of the palimpsest, which is under the text, make that more legible as well.
Professor Easton, how successful have you been at that with this particular document?
Well, actually, the students have done pretty much everything that needed to be done on it. But I went and looked. There are posted online copies of the other Egge collections at other institutions. And I went and got some rather low-quality images offline and processed those the best that I could. And I think I found one of the other leaves from this same manuscript shows hints of being palimpsested. So that would be one of the places we would try to go to try to recover that kind of text.
Mm. And if I could just follow up with Professor Hayworth, forgive my ignorance on this, but just understanding who Otto Egge was, you know, he made these leaf collections out of medieval manuscripts that were, you know, damaged in some way, incomplete, and ends up selling them to libraries or collections across the continent here, including the Carey Collection at RIT. But now that you know that at least one of these documents is a palimpsest, that there are these sort of hidden texts that the students have found a way to access, what's the process of putting the other pieces together? I mean, I don't know how many documents or manuscripts there are in the Egge collection across this continent. I don't know if you have a sense for how you can connect what you have to make sure that you have other the other documents that are out there that might, I don't know, give you more of what has been written here. I mean, how complete a picture or incomplete a picture do you have with this early French writing?
Well, I'll tell you what we have. I'm looking at it now, and I'm reading what I can read, and I've transcribed it already. And the undertext is a document which mentions prisoners held prisoners in the context of the clergy. So specifically, they mention a group of five prisoners, which had, and the king, and some kind of issue of the clergy holding these prisoners or keeping them in some kind of monastic place. So it's a really interesting political document, and we assume that. So Otto Egge made a series of portfolios of pieces of manuscripts, which he cut out, and then he bound them all together, kind of like, you know, an anthology. And he sold those. And so what we're trying to do is find the other 39, the corresponding folio 30 of the other 39, and somehow image those, either having them sent to Rochester to be imaged, or maybe if they're close enough to go out and image them ourselves, and then try to piece together the undertext of folio 30 and whatever else we may find.
I mean, there's no way to predict what you will find, but is there a sense from what you already have that if you can pull together other documents and indeed you're able to use this technique that the students have developed, that there are some really interesting or impactful writing to be discovered?
Well, it depends what you mean by impactful or important. I think that you made a distinction earlier when you were talking about Herculaneum about what we really want is, you know, say Philodemus on poetry or something mm-hmm. like that, which was found at Herculaneum or parts of it. But in fact, the history of recovering texts is about two different kinds of documents. It's these, you know, the big stars, the headliners. But it's also really important history about daily life. And throughout the 19th century, for example, most of the documents found in Egypt in the Fayum had to do with reimagining what daily life was like. And it has truly rewritten our understanding of history. And I think that each is important in its own way. One is a little bit flashier, but it doesn't mean that it's less important. So I think that what the students have done is really what's interesting is that it's opened a new chapter, something totally unexpected about, 15th century book trade in France, in Europe, and how, how it actually worked. What were the financial issues involved? What were the political issues? Where did they, you know, what deals did they do?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I always think it is fascinating to try to understand how previous generations lived and what daily life was like, and just the power of this kind of discovery to help us understand that more. I find it remarkable. I mean, Lisa, have you considered the possible impact of this kind of discovery?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it was just great for us to actually find a palimpsest in general, let alone in RIT's library. Mm-hmm. We thought we would have to really go hunting for one. But seeing what the text says underneath and what other documents that we may be able to find, we're really wondering if we can piece it together and create something even more exciting.
And Zoe, how do you feel about the possible impact of this work?
I'm really excited to see what happens when we go finding all of these other pages from this manuscript and really can build a better picture of what ours and the other pages are saying.
Are you someone who, you know, is eager to see the translation and to try to understand it in the context of which it was written, Zoe?
Yeah, I'm excited to see what it really means when we bring the pieces together, because as Greg was saying, a lot of it's covered and the page is like cut off. So I'd really like to learn more about RIT's document here.
Well, we're going to let you go because we're going to bring in another guest in just a moment. But Zoe Lalina, who is a second-year imaging science student, congratulations on your work on this. Truly, truly remarkable. Absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's news around the world. Thank you for sharing part of the story with us, Zoe.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And let's take our only break, and we're going to come back with our guests, who include Lisa Enochs, who's a second-year student majoring in motion picture science and imaging science, Professor Roger Easton, RIT's Chester F. Carlson Center for Imaging Science professor, and Gregory Hayworth, who's an associate professor of English and textual science at the University of Rochester, helping us understand what these students helped discover, a palimpsest, writing, sort of hidden writing, hidden text from the 1400s, which sort of on its own is interesting, but in the larger context of understanding how previous generations lived, how the world has changed, is the writing political or religious in nature? I mean, there's so many interesting questions when these kind of discoveries are made, and it was made right here. And we're going to continue the conversation after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we talk with a former Rochester resident who recently moved back to his native New Zealand, a country where there has been no community transmission of COVID since November 18th. Mike Johansson left the United States on December 29th. He's been quarantining in a barricaded hotel in New Zealand ever since. He'll talk about his time in isolation and how New Zealand is handling the pandemic vis-a-vis the United States. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and I want to bring in Madeline Rose, a U of R student who is the Take Five Scholar in English Literature, Computational Linguistics, and Classical Mythology and Ethics. Maddie, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great to be here.
We're thrilled to have you. And why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the work that you do? And there are certain words that I'm not sure I can actually pronounce, including, is it codicology? How do you pronounce
codicology?
Codicology. Yeah. What is it?
So codicology is the sort of study of manuscripts as physical objects. So not just what they say, but also what type of parchment they're on, that sort of thing. And specifically, I am working on creating a web app for generating catalog entries for otherwise sort of invisible or uncatalogued manuscripts in libraries. Oftentimes, there's just sort of big sections of catalogs that have no entries online, and that leaves these fragments and manuscripts invisible. What I'm hoping to do is create an app that will allow librarians who have not been trained in codicology and the related disciplines to create catalogs and hopefully uncover some interesting things there.
What might they uncover?
So like what Professor Easton and his students Zoe and Lisa were talking about earlier in the program, they mentioned that they were hoping to find additional leaves from this Otto Ege document set. There could be additional leaves from that collection or from other collections in a similar situation that simply just haven't been cataloged yet, and then we would have no way to know about them. Mm.
What drew you to this work, Maddie?
So I'm kind of in between disciplines personally. I'm an English literature student, but I'm also a computational linguistics student, and I'm really interested in how applying computational skills to the humanities can make texts more accessible, both on like an individual level in terms of bringing texts, individual texts online, but also disciplines more accessible. So things like codicology and being able to generate manuscripts when you haven't been formally trained, or generate catalogs when you haven't been formally trained in the discipline.
What were your thoughts in hearing about the developments here in the discovery of this particular palimpsest?
I think it's really incredibly exciting. I personally don't know much about the image processing from the multispectral angle, but it's always really fascinating to uncover new things, and especially new things when we weren't expecting them.
Yeah, let me turn back to the professors here, because it seems that this kind of work, it seems to be news around the world. I mean, this is not just sort of a local news hit here. And, you know, Professor Easton, what are you hearing from colleagues about this particular discovery?
Certainly this is one of several that we've been able to do similar things with, the Archimedes being one. I was going to remind Gregory that at one point we were imaging in Vercelli in Italy and found some palimpsested teaching materials that were utilized in classrooms at the time, and that sort of fits along the lines of the kind of thing we're talking about. But, there's a number of I think we're all at we have the benefit of being sort of in on the ground floor on this application of modern imaging technologies to these historical writings. And we're all very excited that where this could lead.
Professor Hayworth, what are you hearing from colleagues?
Well, there's one colleague in particular who has expressed a real interest in Otto Ege, and she was absolutely astonished. I first told her that you know, the students had found this palimpsest in a book of ours, and she said, "Oh no, are you sure it's not Chaufrut?" And I said, "No. I've looked at it, and it's you know, I described the hand and lettre battante in French, and she was still skeptical. And then I sent her an image that I had processed myself of it, and there was the equivalent of what Rogers and my colleague Chet Van Duzer calls the spectral gasp. This moment when someone sees something in a document that they was totally invisible and is suddenly absolutely visible, and she was so excited and was just a flurry with you know, what next steps to take to try to find the rest of this document.
Now, is there a sense, and this is going to be, I'm going to reveal my ignorance with this question, but, you know, you're also patient with me, and I appreciate that. You know, I am not at all, I don't have any expertise in your field. I find it just absolutely fascinating, and once in a while, The New Yorker publishes an update on Herculaneum, and I get into it all over again. But really, all I know of the field is that limited slice of trying to slowly unravel, unroll, and read, what, 300 to 500 scrolls at Herculaneum. Is there a sense, Professor Hayworth, for how much is out there? And I mean lost works, lost books. I mean, is there any sense of almost a catalog of what is had and what we don't have? I mean, obviously, we're not going to know authors that there is no historical record of. But when you have an author or a philosopher or a writer in which we have partial works or whole works and then mentions of others but no location of those others, you start to get a picture for what may actually be out there. Do we have any kind of a catalog or a sense for what we're looking for?
The short answer to that is no, because you can't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. I tried maybe about 8 years ago by sending out a series of emails to major major collections in Europe. I tried to figure out from the librarians how many manuscripts before 1500 they had which were damaged or palimpsested in some way in some of the major collections. And from the data that I collected then, it suggested that there, at a very minimum, there were 60,000 pre-1500 manuscripts that were in some way damaged or entirely unknown, which reside now in Europe alone. And Europe is only a tiny fraction, of course, of the manuscript world.
Let me get a couple of listener questions in on this subject then. Harrison Brighton says, is there an ideological, theological, or political reason why older texts might have been selected for being overwritten? Professor Hayworth, I'll start with you on that.
Well, I'm not sure about ideological. Usually it's practical. You know the expression, it's all Greek to me? Well, that's what the Latin scribes would write in the margin of a text when they found that they were copying something in a language they didn't know. And they didn't like it. And often the texts that they couldn't read were worthless to them. And so they would erase them and at least in Western Europe, overwrite them with Latin. So that's not exactly ideological. I think it's cultural. Theologically, it's not, you know, I mean, the number of what we consider boring theological texts, how many, you know, Augustine confessions do you really need? You know, I don't know. That's another question. A lot of the texts that were palimpsested have theological writings over the top, but it's not clear that they were motivated by, you know, strong religious prejudices.
Well, I think there is at least maybe vaguely an assumption that religious institutions didn't want certain kinds of documents in circulation in the regular populace, maybe in, I don't know, different eras of history. We are so sort of minimally educated, and I'm putting myself at the top of this list. So we think of, you know, the so-called Dark Ages leading up to you know, before the printing press, certainly before the 1400s, before any sort of Renaissance. And there's an assumption, Professor Hayworth, that, well, religious institutions would have shuttered any hope of spreading interesting writing, political writing, probably cultural expression that might go against certain religious mores. Is there evidence of that?
Well, let's take Aristotle, for example. Aristotle, in the late Middle Ages, was so exciting and interesting to scholars at the University of Paris in theology that they started becoming Aristotelians, to the point where several of them were excommunicated for teaching Aristotle alongside theology. Certainly there are really attractive secular texts. There are lots of secular texts which are, not particularly, Christian, which are frankly sexual. These were things that were often really prized by scholars or certain kinds of bibliophiles, and some of them were lost, but some of them were protected simply because they were kind of like the underground, really kind of subversive texts that people at universities really wanted to read when what they had was not all that interesting.
Yeah, and so I think I contrast maybe a discovery of a document from the 1400s, to the minimal stuff that I've read, Stephen Greenblatt's book, for example, among others, about, documents or books from antiquity and what we might at least have a vague sense of being out there without having the full collection of a certain writer or philosopher or author. Professor Hayworth, were there any periods of time in which it's essentially kind of a black hole that we just don't have much? Do we have more than others in certain centuries? Did it trend in different ways?
Well, that's an interesting question. When Roger and I were last on, we went with Brent Seals, who's leading the Herculaneum Project and who's developed this method for digital unwrapping. And one of his great successes was on a Hebrew manuscript or scroll held in Jerusalem, which he managed to unravel perfectly. And it represented a bit of writing from a period which was one of exactly these black holes in Hebrew literature where there was no writing. We had no examples from it. So, yeah, there's no question that we have lots of black holes scattered around, and we're trying to plug them. So Herculaneum is one of those, but only one of the many, many opportunities we have to, rewrite the history and rediscover literary history.
Well, and Professor Easton, as a professor for imaging science, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure the New Yorker and related publications have turned the lay public onto stories like Herculaneum, perhaps above other interesting stories that we just aren't more commonly familiar with. Are you tired of hearing about Herculaneum, Professor Easton? Do you feel like there's a lot more interesting things to talk about in this field?
I guess I wouldn't say I'm tired of it, but I will say there are some other ones in my experience that I'm working on that might well be just as exciting. And one example of that is the collection of palimpsests at St. Catherine's Monastery in Sinai, right on the slope of Mount Sinai. And we have a project there to try to image the palimpsests in their collection. They had thought they had 60, and now in the course of the project, we now know they have at least 172. We have colleagues in Europe who are studying the images, and we don't know what's going to be in the rest of the palimpsests in that collection that we haven't had a chance to image. In that collection, we found some completely dead languages, Caucasian Albanian, which is a totally dead language. But as a result of the images in that project, scholars are now able to transcribe some of the words in it. So to me, that's really cool.
Yeah. Look, I'm going to ask the question that some listeners probably came to immediately when you said you found Caucasian Albanian, a totally dead language. How do you know it's a totally dead language if you encounter it?
Well, I will say that in our experience, we only know of three scholars who are studying it, and they did know that this particular book that we were imaging was the Gospel Gospel of John, I believe. Greg probably remembers better than I do. And we were imaging in Tbilisi in Georgia, and a scholar was there working with the images that we collected at St. Catherine's, and he would come down the next day and say, I now know what the Caucasian Albanian word is for fish, which he didn't know before. And that was cool. We really enjoyed that.
You want to elaborate, Professor Hayworth, on that one?
Well, those are exciting moments. And there are a variety of you were talking about black holes before, yeah. And Caucasian Albanian is entirely black hole. Imagine if you don't just lose a document, but you lose an entire language. And that's absolutely crucial. One other language that's almost extinct is Mixtec. And we hope with COVID, you know, bring it under control and we can travel this summer, we hope to travel to Mexico and image a newly discovered fragment of Mixtec, which on a manuscript, pre-Columbian manuscript from probably from the 13th century. And there are only four examples of Mixtec left in the world. So the scholars there are kind of like the one, Jost Gippert, who is working on Caucasian Albanian, really excited to try to be able to read this new language, which opens up, you know, kinds of opportunities.
Well, and before I turn back to the students, Professor Hayworth, just one more question about, I think, the value of obtaining these kind of documents, these kind of manuscripts, having them translated, and then trying to get a picture for life in past centuries in different places. If we come across documents from some of these poorly documented times or almost totally undocumented times or places, it's one thing to say, yes, we have a scholar who can translate the language. It's another to be able to understand how to translate it in a way that is valuable, to at least paint maybe sort of a helpful picture for what life is like in context, because the context with action changes over time. Governmental structures change over time. Sort of socioeconomic structures change over time. How do we have the context to really understand, you know, when we acquire these rare documents, to get the understanding that we're looking for to really get value out of them?
Well, I should say a couple of things first. I think we need to eat from the corners. It's kind of like doing a huge crossword puzzle and knowing a few of the clues from your knowledge of history, but piecing together what things are and conjecturing the ones that must be. And we use those as little building blocks, small building blocks, which not over you know, multiple generations sometimes additively gives us a sense of the period. I think it's the best we can do.
Hmm. Well, let me ask the students how their work now moves into a next phase, especially because the pandemic's not over. I mean, Lisa Enoch's a second-year student double majoring in motion picture science and imaging science. You've been involved with such an exciting project. But was your work inhibited by the pandemic at all, and is it inhibited going forward?
Definitely at the start when the pandemic kind of started and everything was shut down, it was really hard to work because me and my two teammates were all in different places. So we were kind of assembling our system individually. So when we finally got to, you know, go to our university in our lab and put it together and we could finally make sure that it worked, make sure that all of our motors and our GUI and software and everything worked, then it was really good to see that we were actually able to make something during this pandemic, and let alone something that can find palimpsest.
Yeah.
It was just really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely, Lisa. And maybe you can answer our listener named Andrew's question, who just wants to know, how do you work with old manuscripts without damaging them? That's probably different in a lot of different settings, depending on the materials, the age, etc. But you want to take that a little bit, Lisa?
Yeah, so we usually get them from our curator in the Carey Collection. His name is Steve Galabreth. He gives us the manuscripts in these big pages, so they're not really taped in, but they're pretty secure in there. So we have to be a little bit careful while transporting them to our lab, but when we're actually taking them out, it's really just kind of being careful, only touching them around the edges, being careful not to get a lot of finger oil on them. But apart from that, it's just kind of gentle care, but you can touch the manuscripts to move them around.
Maddie, how has your work been affected by the pandemic, and what's next for you?
To touch on the pandemic bit first, I have thankfully been pretty lucky in that myself and my partners on the project, including Professor Hayworth, as well as another undergraduate student, Jess Palmigiano, and Ilya Dinas at the Library of Congress, since we're not working with text directly, meeting over Zoom and then just kind of going off and sort of like programming on our own or sending around documents has been pretty straightforward. There are definitely times when it would have been really useful just to be able to like all sit down in person in the same room. But I think this project is a little bit luckier in the fact that it's definitely easier to organize something that doesn't require us to be as hands-on with the material.
Sure. Yeah. And speaking of hands-on, Professor Easton, what would you say to Andrew who wanted to know how you work with these kind of manuscripts and materials without damaging them?
Touch them. The conservators who know what they're doing are the ones who touch them. On the Archimedes palimpsest, that was the case. That's a very damaged object. Parchment by itself, if it's well treated, is very tough. It's like shoe leather. But the Archimedes had been significantly moldy. It had been like kept in a damp basement. So we didn't touch it. The scholars did. The conservators did.
Sure. And I'm sure, Professor Easton, some manuscripts are more fragile than others, and probably it's case by case based on age and condition and where it's been stored, among many other factors. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Professor Hayworth, Andrew follows up to say, is there a market for forgery of this stuff?
Oh, there's always a market for forgery.
Is there really?
And that brings us into some... Actually, that brings us in a strange way back actually to Herculaneum, but also to the classical world and forgeries in the classical world that have made their ways into, modern collections. And the usefulness of various imaging techniques and forensic imaging techniques, to try to detect forgeries and make sure that people who have a knowledge of codicology, for example, don't use that to, make money and profit off of, unknown texts and kind of rewrite history the wrong way.
I was going to ask what the possible motivation would be, given how, sort of niche this is. But I guess the answer is that people would do it if they think they can make money. There's money in it.
Oh, yes. Oh, there's a lot of money. The same thing, obviously, for paintings. Any kind of forgery of cultural heritage objects, there's always someone who's willing to pay a lot of money. What Otto Ege did in breaking books was really a horrible thing. He's taking an object which was coherent and had an identity, and he's scattering it so that we don't know the context. It's kind of like doing archaeology, digging something up, and then destroying the site from where you dug it up. And you can't tell. There's so much to learn from the context. And what the students were doing is help us put together that context again. But Ege, and a lot of people are doing this to this day. They realized from Ege, among other people, that they can make money by taking a relatively boring manuscript, which is pretty, cutting it up and selling it piecemeal to people who have something to put on their walls and aren't really interested in the history or the object itself, just as a bit of decoration. So we're also working against both of those instincts, the desire to make money off these cultural heritage objects, which I think should belong to everyone. And I think Roger would immediately agree with me on that. And also this, the forgery, the falsification of history.
Professor Easton, let me just squeeze in a question from Barbara in Brighton. What's the difference between a palimpsest and a tentament?
Word? That's not a word I'm familiar with.
Yeah, that's not one I know either. Professor Hayworth, do you know the word?
I think a tentamen is an attempt at something in Latin, but I think what she means is a pentimento, And a pentimento is a painting under a painting.
I see. Okay, so there is similarity, right? A palimpsest is a text under a text, right?
Exactly. So in a textual world, the pentimento is the artistic equivalent of the palimpsest.
I think I translated the word from the caller wrong. Barbara, I hope that's the answer to you. So it's the text equivalent. It's a very interesting subject and really, really great stuff this hour. 30 seconds, Professor Hayworth. I think Aga said that what he was doing was the democratization of knowledge. Sounds like you disagree.
Rubbish. He's trying to make a buck. In fact, it was his wife who did it, but he started it. I really don't believe that.
Well, here we are, and thanks to the students like Zoe and Lisa, creative students like Maddie, and frankly, the collaboration between RIT and U of R, here we are now with a chance to maybe get it right. And it's really, really remarkable to see what everyone has been doing. Professor Easton, to you and the students, congratulations. Cheers. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Professor Hayworth, always appreciate the time. Fascinating. Thanks for the expertise.
Thanks a lot.
Lisa Enox, good luck to you. Boy, thanks for sharing this remarkable story with us this hour.
Thank you very much.
And Maddie Rose, thanks for sharing your knowledge as well, and good luck in the endeavors that you have in this industry.
Thank you.
Really great stuff. Thanks to Zoe Lalina as well, an RIT student. And there, see, what a great news story with such interesting stuff to get our mind off the rest of the modern world. We'll go back to that in just a moment, or maybe tomorrow on Connections. With Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer, I'm Evan Dawson. We will talk with you Thursday on member-supported public radio.